Welcome everyone to the Mitch Docker episode of Sigma Sports Presents Matt Stevens Unplugged. Now, we all know Mitch as one of the real characters of the pro peloton with a penchant for retro cycling fashion, and we certainly talk all about that. Now, the EF Education Nippo rider also explains to me what a tramp bike is. Yes, it was a steep learning curve. We also chat about how he got into cycling as a youngster. The Melbourne quiz has no questions at all about neighbours in it, believe it or not. Mitch isn't from Erinsborough after all. And if you've ever wondered what Mitch's name would be if he was in the Spice Girls, you've come to the right place. Check it out. Hello and welcome. Are you ready?
Because it's that time again. Matt Stevens Unplugged by Sigma Sports.
Stone Circle is back in June 2024. Forget your Glastonbury's and your Coachella's, this is the midsummer festival every gravel rider needs on their calendar. With three awesome routes, 55k, 155k and 220k's, there really is something for everyone. There's also a campsite with showers, hot food, cold beer, an optional fancy dress hill climb and lots of other fun stuff to make it the best weekend of 2024. Prices from £55, book Stone Circle today at hotchili.com and get a fiver off with the code PODCAST5. Hot Chili is spelled HOTCHILLLE and .com is spelled full stop COM. Mitch Docker is an instantly recognisable character. With his thick Ned Flanders moustache and flowing Chris Waddle mullet, the man has unquestionable style, both on and off the bike. Riding with EF Education Nippo and in the autumn of his career now, we chat about all he's achieved as well as the pressures and rewards of becoming a road captain. The random question generator is primed and the Melbourne quiz is ready to test his knowledge on his hometown. But what would he call his own coffee brand? Should Rigoberto Urán allow him a temporary installation in his Rigo Superstore? And what would the logo feature? There's only one way to find out. Check it out. Well, Mitch, first and foremost, mate, thank you very, very much for coming on to Matt Stevens Unplugged. How the devil are you?
I'm well, mate. Thanks for having me. It's exciting to be on a different podcast. As you know, some people may or may not know out there, I've got my own podcast. It's always nice to be on the other side because you don't have to do anything. You can just come on and talk. So it's awesome.
Yeah, you just roll up and... I mean, I did one a couple of months ago for an American guy, and you just roll up. It's no prep. You don't need to do. You just literally turn up, and it's quite chilled.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, it's like, all right, let's go.
Let's just do this. What I need to do first, just kind of set things up. What I normally do when we set up this pod is ask the person on the end, i.e., you in this case, where in the world you are, and what you can see immediately around you in the room that you're in, just so we can get a real sense of where you are, mate.
I'm in Girona, Spain at the moment, and we have a house here, and I'm sitting out on the balcony, the front balcony, and I'm looking down on the lawn, which is fake grass, but it always looks beautiful. That's what I love about it. It looks perfectly green and perfectly cut every time I look at it.
That's nice.
And I can see my car in front on a quiet street. And it's a beautiful sunny day. The sun hasn't come into the balcony yet, but it won't be long until that is jamming in on me, probably throughout this podcast.
Very, very nice. And I can actually hear a few songbirds sort of chirping in the background as well.
Yep. They are. Beautiful. I can hear them too.
Absolutely beautiful. And are you wearing, if you don't mind me asking, are you wearing a Mapai running vest? Because I hope you are.
I'm not. I've only got one of them, and I save it for special occasions because I know that thing's going to wear out one day, and I'll never be able to get another one.
I mean, I know we've gone off on a bit of a tangent already, but if anybody is wondering what the heck I'm talking about, Mitch, as many of you will know, is a big fan of running, or over recent years, running in a headband, shorts, trainers, but importantly, a quite impressive Mapai kind of old school running vest. Can you tell us where you got that from, Mitch, and kind of what inspired you to purchase it?
I didn't purchase it. And most of my retro stuff, I've been lucky enough to get – I'm talking about cycling stuff now too.
Yeah.
I've been lucky enough to be gifted it, which I think is even more special.
Right.
I realized once I became in the pro world that all this stuff that I love, all the guys that I hang around with, directors, doctors or mechanics, they've all been in those – teams or know guys who are in those teams. So you have access to all that stuff.
Yeah.
And most people aren't that interested in it, pros that I mean. So if you actually just say, hey, I'm really interested and chat to them about it, they're like, you know what? I've actually got heaps of that crap I'd like to get rid of. The Map A singlet was a slightly different story.
Okay.
There was a guy who was a sports scientist who worked with Green Edge back in the day. His name was Paolo. And he was running in Australia. And it's the complete set. He's got the Map A hoop running shorts too. I never got those.
Oh, wow.
And he would just turn up every day in this Map A, because he worked at the Map A Center, Italian guy. And he would just turn up every day in Australia with come back from his run, and he'd be in this Map A kit. And I'm like, this is just insane. I just fell in love with it. And eventually at the end of the camp, he goes, you can have the singlet. I was like, so great. And I've cherished it ever since.
What a lovely little story. I mean, you're right, though. I mean, I've still got, I think, some kit from my pro days, like 20 years ago. Actually, I've got a jersey from every single team, pro team and amateur team that I've rode with since the 80s, including like a woolen jersey and a silk jersey from way back in the early 80s that my dad gave me. I love all that stuff. But yeah, I've got a real penchant for kind of old stuff now, and I do make sure that I keep hold of it, because every now and again when I'm rummaging under the bed looking for something, I find an old bit of kit, and I invariably just stick it on Instagram. People love all that sort of stuff, don't they? Like nice condition retro kit, something really special about it.
Yeah, the one, just as you're hearing you say, the one piece of kit that I've got that is probably one of the most special bits I've got is we have this bus driver in Green Edge, and his name is Ortathu. And he rode on Onsei. And
right, okay.
I loved the pink Onsei kit. And I just loved Onsei kit full stop. And Neil Stevens was on Onsei. And I found out Ortathu was on Onsei. I didn't even know he was a pro rider. And then I found he was on Onsei, and he was actually a really sick rider. And right. I just started speaking to him one day. Same story. Loved Onsei. Eventually I said to him, mate, you wouldn't have anything around, like an old headband or, you know, a funny beanie or something. The next race, he came with a pink long sleeve Onsei jersey for me. I was just get out. And his name written on the inside collar. And Neil Stevens pulled me inside and he goes, mate, I don't know if you know how special that is. Ortathu only rode one tour. And if anyone doesn't know, the Onsei kit was only for the tour team, the pink one. Yeah. He only rode one tour. And back in those days, it was Vuelta Giro Tour. And he did the Vuelta. Yeah. Giro, and then he was in the tour last minute, got called in. So he was completely buggered. Did the team's time trial, didn't make time cut, had to pull out.
Oh, no.
So we'd have bugger all of that kit, and he decided to give me one of his long sleeves. I was just so honored. And, like, apart from it being cool, it's just sort of like he gifted it to me, and I was like, this is super, super special. So I love that stuff.
I love all that stuff. Russell, you know Russell Downing used to ride for Sky. A good mate of mine, the other day, he saw me on Insta and on Zwift riding in with a couple of headbands. And then he sent me a retro headband from 1995 from LA Sheriff, the American team, one of Malcolm Elliott's kind of headbands. And I've got that. And I was so stoked just to get it through the post in a little jiffy bag. It's absolutely wonderful. So have you got a collection of headbands as well?
I do, but not pro. I've only got one Onsei one, a yellow one.
Okay.
And actually, I've finally, whether it was me, I don't know, but Rafa finally made a headband for the Giro. And I wasn't on that Giro, but I was lucky enough to get one sent out for me. So I've got that too. I'm going to be rocking that one around too.
Okay. I was just wondering how you stored your headbands as well. I know you've only got two, but because I actually wear mine, but I store them on the drop handlebar bit of my wife's bike, which she never uses, in my Zwift room. So it's like a little loop, like a little headband hanger, as it were.
That's the thing. they wear out quickly. You know, they lose their stretch.
Yep.
I do have a whole lot of headbands, but the only two cycling ones. They're hard to come by. I reckon they need to make a strong comeback.
Mate, I reckon, I mean, and I know we're going off on a real tangent. I know you sell your own kind of hats for your, maybe Mitch Docker headbands, mate. I think you would, just an idea, mate. I think that would go down so well. Get his little logo sorted out. I think it'd be amazing. I think you'd sell out.
I was really surprised. I do this other little podcast of mine. It's called Talking Luft.
Yes.
It's all about style.
Yep.
And one of the questions I ask in it is, if you could have raced back in the day without a helmet, what would you have done? And I give some suggestions. Would you have raced without a helmet, just hair flowing? Would you race with a sausage helmet? Would you race with a cap? And I throw the last one in because this is what I would have done. Would you have raced with a headband? 99 people say, never say headband, a cap, helmet. The one person I never expected to say headband, who do you think that was?
Oh, Charlie Wegelius?
Tom Pidcock.
Blimey.
I was just like, dude, you've just gone up about 10 notches in my book. I did not expect that at all. It was awesome.
I listened to that podcast a couple of weeks ago. I thought it was a great podcast, by the way. But I don't remember him answering that question. But that you wouldn't have expected that of such a young kid, really, would you? Well, right. He's a young man, isn't he?
That's brilliant.
Very, yeah, that's cool. Well, okay, I'll tell you what, we'll probably get back on to fashion in a little bit. But what I'd like to, well, first off, last time we chatted, I was in Henry VIII's front garden, where I was describing to you a robot lawnmower. And then one thing led to another, and we couldn't continue the conversation because I was going to a flower show, wasn't I?
Yes.
And then, obviously, in between then, there's a small race called the Giro d'Italia has happened. And also, well, a big race called Trobro León. So was that your last event, mate?
It was, yep. That was a couple of weeks ago now. That was my last race.
And how was it? Because I know you've, because of COVID and stuff, there's been, for a lot of riders, including yourself, a kind of more focused race calendar, isn't there? So kind of limited race days. But that to me looked like a race that you would really enjoy. Did you enjoy it?
I tell you, I really built it up a lot. And I thought it was going to be awesome. And I even said this at the start of the year. I was on the Giro long list. And I was also on Trobro. And I thought, you know what? I don't really care which race I get. If I get the Giro, great. It's a great race. If I don't get the Giro, I've got Trobro because that's an awesome race too.
Yeah.
And I was really thinking it's going to be another style of Roubaix. It's a pretty grimy, hard race. The sectors, the weird thing about the sectors is if you try and compare it to Roubaix, is the Roubaix sectors sort of take an edge off the riders. So you have this big fight to get to the sector. Everyone gets their position and you come off the sector and everyone's sort of a bit out of breath. So no one really moves up too much and everyone gets their position and that's sort of how it goes. Trobro was sort of not like that. You fought for the sector. You almost got recovery on the sector because no one could move and it was quite easy riding on there physically.
Right.
And then you came off and it was this whole washing machine effect again. And that's what it was the whole race. And potentially for me not having a lot of races this year, I was out of touch with the fight.
Yeah.
And it was just a very bad weather and it was a tough race. It sort of brought me back to reality very quick. But I think it's one of those races which is quite often the case with the races, you look back on it fondly. In the moment, I wasn't loving it, but I'm sort of getting to that point now where you're like, it was pretty cool actually.
Yeah. I mean, it's, if anybody's wondering what we're talking about, I mean, generally, if you're listening to this pod, you'll kind of heard of Trobro León, but it's a race that's held in kind of northwestern France, isn't it? Kind of undulating terrain, but it features basically farm, not cobbles, it's like farm dirt tracks, isn't it really? And a lot of them with grass going out the middle. And it's kind of famous because of if you're the best French rider, or regional rider in the race, you win a piglet. So there's a lot of kind of mythos around the race, but it's kind of growing in stature year on year, isn't it?
It is. I don't know. I'm wondering how it would go. I'm seeing myself, how would this race be as a World Tour race?
Yeah.
Because the race that we raced was, and I don't necessarily mean to use it in a negative way, it was race very amateur-y style in terms of no control, anything could happen, groups were attacking, there was no... formalities to the race, which can be good too, because sometimes a World Tour race has too much of that and it gets too, precision like.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, maybe it doesn't need to go to World Tour this and maybe it needs to stay as it is. And I was like, well, maybe if it does go to World Tour, maybe it'll be another style of race, like, say, Strade Bianchi. But I don't know. I'm a bit torn.
Yeah, I think just the images as a fan of the sport. Actually, I managed a team, Sigma Sports, a few years ago, a UCI team, we sent them over and we rode Tour de Finistère and Trobro León and lads absolutely loved it. And I think we only had one finisher, but they absolutely loved it. A real experience for them. But mate, let's rewind your life. Not all of it, because otherwise you have no memory. It would just be like space or something. What's your first memory, Mitch, of swinging a leg over a bike? Your very, very first memory of propelling yourself forward on these wonderful machines that we love so dearly?
Probably my first memories are of, I've got a couple of cousins. I've got quite a lot of cousins, but two boy cousins who live up on a bit of a property, Cameron and Broderick, their names are.
Yeah.
And they're both younger than me. And I used to – I'm the youngest of three in my family. I've got an older sister and then an older brother. And when I was probably at about 10 years old, I think, or maybe eight, I used to go up there for the weekend and we would make they had an old tennis court that was like one of those things – that gets sort of half built but never gets finished. It was like, oh, the tennis court, I've dug the hole out, it's been excavated flat, and that's where it stays for like 40 years, you know?
Yeah, I know what you mean, yeah.
And so we used to just build bike jumps in there and, you know, ride around in the dirt. And, you know, that's the first real memory I have of just like racing in a way. We'd make a track and we'd race around it BMX style, try and, you know, go through every puddle and,
yeah,
that sort of thing. That's probably my first memory back in the day.
What bike were you riding back then?
Well, I wouldn't know the actual brand of it. It was just like a silver BMX that got sort of handed down from my brother. And then I was riding it. I actually ended up turning that into a tramp bike. Do you know what a tramp bike is?
No, I don't. Tell me. I'm intrigued.
Well, there's this thing I never probably saw. It's just where you... where you just eventually you take the cranks off it, and then you tape up where the bottom bracket is. Like you put towels around that, and then put duct tape around that, and then where the rear stays are, you take the wheel out and the front wheel out, and you put tape around that and around that, and then you jump on the trampoline and do tricks with it.
I've never heard anything. So I thought you meant a tramp bike, like a bike that was looked like it was homeless.
Oh, no.
But this is like a trampoline bike.
Yeah. You do like bar spins and stuff. And if it falls on the trampoline, it doesn't put a hole in the mat.
Wow. So you're doing like tricks on a wheelless bike.
Yeah.
Basically.
Almost. Yeah.
Wow. Honestly, mate, I've never heard of that. Was that like just an Australian thing or a regional thing?
I got no idea. It gives it another life, you know?
Bloody hell. Yeah. That's I'm just trying to envisage it, but wow, that's incredible, mate. That's incredible. I was kind of thrown me. It's so kind of marvelous. So when did you kind of first get to the point where you thought, actually, I really like riding my bike. I'm obviously reasonably good. When did kind of the kind of proposition of racing come to present itself to you?
I was always sort of, the weird thing was I was sort of always interested in racing, whether it was, because the thing, well, especially when I was going to school, there was no real bike racing as I knew it anywhere, you know, and I wasn't really in that scene. My dad was riding. He was riding bunch rides and watching the Tour de France. And from primary school, I was doing quite a lot of cross country and running, and then I was playing more team sports. I was quite a good cricketer and rugby player. My dad's from Sydney, so we lived in Melbourne, but my dad was from Sydney, so we grew up with rugby. And when I went to high school, again, I was just, you could tell I wasn't the best, like as in the cross country stuff, but I was always in the top five sort of stuff. So you knew like you were pretty gifted in, you know, the aerobic sort of ability.
Decent engine.
Yeah, exactly. But I was never looking to race cross country or running or whatever. I just sort of wasn't good enough and it wasn't enough for me. And then we, in 2000 for the Olympics, all the Australians, there wasn't enough access for tickets. So what they just did is they put this ballot in and you just submitted, okay, we want five tickets, and then you just got random tickets. And some of the random tickets we got, among others, was the track cycling and the last night of the velodrome.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything really about velodrome racing or track cycling then, and I didn't know anyone on it, you know, any names or anything. Australia was okay, but they weren't like they were the years to follow or what they are now.
Yeah.
And that night was quite a good night. Gary Niewon, he attacked the Kieran. As soon as the bike came off, he just went. And he got sort of like a quarter of a lap, and the crowd was just like erupting, like, oh, my gosh, he's going to get it. And he got pipped on the line.
Oh, no.
And the French guy that beat him, I can't remember exactly who it was, but anyway, everyone was just like, oh, my gosh, that was just incredible. I was like, that was so good, you know?
Yeah.
Then the Madison started.
Yeah.
And little did I know that Scott McGorry and Brett Aiken, and also I've since found out the general media didn't pump them up to be the favorites, even though they were the best Madison riders in the world.
Yeah.
at the World Championships the year before, which is what the Australian media based sort of their build up on.
Sure.
Brett Aiken had a crash, and Scott McGorry rode the last half of the race on his own, and they finished ninth, and they just sort of looked like a bit of a shit team. So the Australian media said, yeah, we might have a chance for a medal, maybe. But they were actually the best team. They were the ones to lose.
Yeah.
So no one knew anything. And so when they started coming around and looking like it was going to win, we were like feeling like we were the underdogs, you know?
Yeah.
Long story short, that night hooked me. I was just like, whoa, what is this? This is just so awesome. And Dad, traveling around Melbourne doing work, had seen this velodrome not far from us, Brunswick.
Yeah.
And in Melbourne City. And there was a sign there that just said Sunday morning clinic, all welcome. So we rolled up the next Sunday, whenever it was, late sort of 2000 or early 2001, I think it was, in the summer. And it was a free clinic where they had sort of 100 bikes that sort of fit more or less everyone's size. And someone might ride your bike in the race before and you'll just put the seat up and ride in the next race. And it was a really great community there that no stigma attached or anything like that. You could just wear shorts and a t-shirt and just put your runners in and pull the clips up on your shoes and just go around and race. And if you didn't like it, you didn't have to go back. You hadn't gone out and bought a bike or whatever. That's really where I started. And at the end of that summer season, they said to me, well, you've got a bit of go. How about you try something in the winter, the road stuff? And I was like, what's the road? And, you know, that's sort of where I went. Yeah.
I love the fact that there's a kind of a degree of chance in that, like the fact that you only got tickets to the velodrome by the ballot. And I know in the UK in 2012, in London, 2012, because everything was oversubscribed, there was a ballot for a lot of the sports because a lot of the tickets just go to corporate people first. Then essentially it's a ballot. So it's the kind of luck of the draw. But the fact that, you know, 20 years later, you're sat here coming towards the end of your, you know, wonderful career in cycling. It was a kind of almost like a butterfly effect moment, a sliding doors moment. You know, what would you have done? I mean, you might have ended up cycling, who knows? But I love the fact that there's a real degree of chance and that you followed it. And also how Olympic Games in particular can be pivotal in terms of inspiring kids or anybody to get involved in sport. I love that.
Yes, as someone in that position, as a professional in a sport, you have to sometimes stop and think when you are meeting young kids that is that moment. It's so influential. I remember also back to when I was in primary school. I don't know how this ever happened because fencing is definitely not a popular sport in Australia, let alone the whole world. But back in my primary school, randomly we had a fencing expedition and I did fencing for a couple of years. It hooked me, you know. Right, I remember my mum was like, "Okay, if you're sure you want to do that, you know."
But
like,
as kids, what we used to play sword fights, didn't we? So it's a kind of like it's like posh sword fighting, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it was a dream, and there's one fencing clinic in the whole of Melbourne. You're just thinking, my mum's probably thinking, "God, I hope he doesn't click onto this." But you know, that it faded. But I just think about how influential that one little exhibition was for me. And you think yourself as a pro now, the kids that you meet along the way, you give a hat or a bottle or something to, it can mean so much. You don't realize.
No, it's very, very cool. I mean, and then how did you end up ultimately? Because you remember your first proper race on the road then? Because I can remember mine like it was as clear as yesterday. My dad's still scarred from it because he was so embarrassed at my performance. But that's another story. So what was your first race?
My first memory of that is very similar to what you just said. We do a lot of handicap racing in Australia, as I think you do in the UK too. It was a junior race. And I remember Dad saying, because it was all boys and girls mixed, you know.
Yeah,
I came in at whatever position I came in. Dad's like, oh, you got beaten by a girl, you know, like making a big scene of it. Because, you know, it was a handicap race. And it was cold racing. You had to really love it when I think about it now because it was an hour and a half out of Melbourne. I was at high school, private school, which had compulsory Saturday sport. So I was playing rugby in the morning, jump in my dad's van, and we'd drive out and race bikes in the afternoon. And they were cold, windy, wet days, like UK sort of days. And I loved it. You know, I think about it then, there was probably only 10 starters on the line, no real atmosphere whatsoever, and quite a cliquey crew out there. You know, everyone who was there was, their fathers had been some kind of rider, so their sons were doing it, and there weren't really many outsiders who were completely novice to the whole situation coming in, and it was quite intimidating
when I think about it.
But I guess I wanted it so much that you just went, you didn't care about all that. You just jumped in as a kid and just went for it.
And how did you do?
In that first race or
In the first race.
Well, I got beaten. I got beaten by a couple of girls, I wasn't fastest time. I think I went off second scratch, and who knows? Like, it was just hard.
I remember my first race was actually on the site, one of the sites, the Olympic Games. Now it's a place called Eastway. It's a closed circuit race, a closed kind of mile and a half circuit with a couple of climbs in it. In the middle of it was a BMX track and a mountain bike. It's really, really good. They had a Tour de France stage there in the 70s, Merckx rode around it. But basically I started off, and I just couldn't get my foot in the toe clips. So I was on the start line and the bunch had gone around the first corner. So I spent the entire race on my own and got lapped within about 3 laps. And my dad was just at the side of the side of the course with his head in his hands. I think he was crying, what on earth? And it was back then I was so little that the kind of seat was lowered onto the top tube and I had a number on that was like a sail. You know, the numbers in the olden days were like enormous. You could wrap them around a child. Mm. But it was only like pinned in 4 places. So it was just a sail. I remember it but it wasn't, it was quite scarring really, because my dad didn't really talk to me on the way home. It was a pushy parent or anything, but anyway.
I remember also just thinking of a sail. I remember seeing a photo of myself in one of those early days, and I used to love the look of the polka dot jersey. So I would just, I didn't really know the significance of wearing a polka dot jersey or a yellow jersey, or I even had a world champ jersey too. I just wear around.
Yeah.
Just because I liked the look of them. And this jersey was so big. When I look at this photo, it's like you said, a parachute polka dot jersey. So yeah, it's funny.
I love all that. Oh, hold on a minute, mate. There's something happening in the background.
Random question alert.
Oh.
Random question alert. It is time for a random question.
Right. Sorry about that, Mitch. I forgot to warn you. A couple of times during the podcast, the Sigma Sports guys installed a big old-fashioned, I think it's ex-Soviet computer in the corner of my loft. And every now and again, it just kicks off and fires a random question. So here it is. I've just torn off the slip. Wow. Okay, this is quite hard. Okay. If you were to count out loud, what number do you think you could count to without abbreviating, shortening, or skipping any numbers? So imagine you got a pound, euro, dollar for every number you counted to, but if you made a mistake, you'd get nothing. That's quite a good. So basically, if I was to say, like, Mitch, keep counting, we'll give you a euro for every single number you got right. How far do you think you could get, but you had to say each number out in full?
1,000, maybe.
1,000, and then you'd start to lose your memory, do you think?
I think without making a mistake. Yeah,
mistake.
Like you just get eventually, you'd stop thinking about it and you'd make a mistake. Like 1,000, that's a lot.
That is a lot, just to say it out. That
I
is
a lot.
I would
say probably only a few hundred now I think about it. Maybe 500.
Yeah. I was going to say maybe 42,000, but then now you've kind of really thought about it. I think that's a gamble because you'd lose all your money.
That's so long.
Yeah, I couldn't get to that bit, mate. I think I'd just get bored as well and just take the money, because 1,000 euros for just doing that is quite a good deal, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it'd be quite good just to sort of focus on that and then, you know, just maybe go like 1,020 just to get another 20 in the pocket.
Yeah, and just really take your time, really, really take your time. There we go, random question generator. Nice one, mate.
Hot Chili's London to Paris Gravel Adventure is a breathtaking 3-day ride that will stay with you forever. Trundle down towpaths, cruise across farm tracks, meander through woodlands, and take in the scenery on a route that's almost entirely off-road all the way from the Thames to the Seine. In fact, the route into Paris was designed by Sofiane Sahely, the king of French gravel, so you can be confident it's the best possible off-road route to the Eiffel Tower. The Hot Chili Ride Captains will be there to show you the way, whilst the experienced event crew look after everything else so you can relax and truly enjoy the adventure. Treat yourself to a well-earned massage at lunch or at the end of each day, then relax over dinner and get a good night's kip at 3-star and 4-star hotels. Make September 2024 the highlight of your calendar and head to hotchili.com to find out more about the Hot Chili Difference. Psst, podcast listeners can get 50 quid off entry. Just use the code PODCAST50 at the checkout, but don't tell anyone that doesn't listen to the podcast, okay?
Right, okay. Sort of back to the future. Well, not the future, back to now. As pretty much all of us know, this is going to be your last year as a pro, mate. I mean, you've had a great career. You know, you're a really popular figure in cycling. I know you're going to be sorely missed. I've no doubt you're going to miss being a pro. But at what point, mate, did you come to this decision? Was it quite a recent one, or was it something that you've kind of, if this was like 2021, the end of 21, something you'd had on the horizon for a while? When did you come to the decision, Mitch?
I think last year had a big impact. I think everyone had a bit of a funny sort of year last year, and that's understating it. I came to the end of last year, and it was no guarantee I was going to get a contract with this team. We got our contracts cut in half, so we're all on half wage. And then there was this sort of word going around that everyone who took a pay cut, which is everyone, was going to get offered a contract, because you weren't really able to show yourself in the lack of racing we had unless you did the tour or something. So you sort of were a bit limited to get out to other teams as well. And every team, it was just a funny year at the end of the year. And I thought, you know what? I'm not ready to retire like this. But I was feeling a bit, I was starting to feel the signs of it in terms of when I came back to racing last year, I went into it red hot, you know, like I came in, trained really hard because I thought, I don't know how long this racing is really going to go. So I started with Strada Bianchi. I was like, it could be Strada Bianchi in San Remo and we could be back in lockdown. So I was like, well, every race matters. So I'm just going to hit it red hot. And I was going well. And I went in there and I was just another number still. Everyone was going good. And we saw that happen in every race. It was so exciting to watch.
It was almost like every race was the last race. I think everybody in the industry, especially within the teams and race organizers, and it was as if this could literally be the last race for a long time. So there was a sense of kind of urgency and like, we've got to make this one matter. And would I be correct in saying it kind of impacted the racing a little bit?
It did. And I want to say is that I sort of expected, okay, well, that was a crazy year last year and we'll start this year and we'll see what happens. But that's just the new standard now.
Right, okay.
And as you've probably seen from the racing, if we go back to the start of the year, a race like Hood Var, I did, that race was so hard. It was Paris-Nice hard, and it was one of the first races of the year.
Mate, I commentated on it. Well, I was like me and, I think it was me and Lloydie. It was like, oh my God, this is so aggressive. It was a bit like, not in a bad way, a bit like an amateur race. It was just attacks all from the start, every stage.
With the best riders in the world, you know? Was just... I started to see the writing on the wall here. I'm like, well, look, I'm seeing increases in my performance, in my numbers and things like that, but it's still just putting me in the middle of the bunch. In order for me, well, maybe in the middle or maybe towards the back as well, you know, like in order for me to keep going at this game, I need to commit more. I need to sacrifice more. And I got to the point where I'm like, I don't know if I really want to be honest. I'm still love riding my bike. I've got two kids now, and the impact of last year has made me really realize how important that is and how more important the extended family is to me.
Of course.
And 13 years in the peloton, I'm so happy with it. And I sort of realized, what more do I really need to achieve to feel any more satisfied than I do now? And I thought, nothing really. I've loved it. I've got no regrets. And to keep going is a lot more sacrifice. I sort of went, I'm okay now where I'm at. And I just sort of felt this moment of, it'd be nice to step away before I really go one or two more years on and just go, I'm really hating this now. This is shit. And I just thought, it's a nice moment. And just made that decision pretty much after opening weekend. I think this year I was just like, you know what? I just didn't love it out there today. I knew what to do for my job. it really became a job, but the enjoyment sort of drifted away, and I was like, okay, it could be time.
Yeah. I mean, it's nice to do that on your own terms as well, have that year contract, you know, but do it on your kind of own terms. But I guess, though, I know we all know that one of your favorite races, and one of the favorite races for any kind of cycling fan, as well as the Grand Tours, is Paris-Roubaix. And that's obviously been one of the few races that was rescheduled to the end of the year. I know you're not guaranteed to ride that, but I guess that would be a lovely kind of way to end your career, ideally, wouldn't it?
Perfect. Yeah, it'd be perfect. And when it sort of got moved, because I was sort of banking on doing Roubaix this year to sort of make a decision for me, I sort of thought, I'll let Roubaix decide. You know, I'll go to Roubaix, yeah. And if I feel like really, oh, man, I love this, I need to be here, then I'll keep going on. But when it didn't happen, like I said, I went through that thought process and went, I don't need to be here for any other reason anymore. I decided to call it, and then I thought, wow, this is actually maybe a blessing in disguise. I get to finish on Roubaix. And sort of that just sort of sounded nice.
Yeah. No, it's well, thanks for that, mate. We're gonna move on now to something completely different. And I'm actually gonna sing a jingle because we haven't got one prepared. No, basically what I'm gonna do, well, obviously I have listened to your Talking Luft quite a few times. I really like it. So I'm gonna take a leaf from Luft, and I've made a bespoke section of Matt Stevens Unplugged. Just for you. It's called Mitch's Mullet Memories. Mitch's Mullet Memories. There we go. What we'll do, we'll probably put a bit of kind of music around that. So Niall, get on the case of that one, bud. He's great with the soundboards. Right, okay, so slightly more rapid fire kind of feel to it. Kind of looking back of your career, but more briefly, Mitch. Favorite kit of yours as a pro? So the one you wore.
It's between two.
Yep.
My 2010 Skill Shimano kit, which is before the white shorts, but after my 2009 kit, they sort of just made some slight adjustments. 210 Skill Shimano, which is very similar to Sean Kelly Skill Shimano, a skill kit.
Yeah.
And the first edition Rafa EF kit, where it's finally, I felt for a long time in Mitchelton, I was always trying to make adjustments to make the kit look somewhat cool.
Okay.
And I finally got EF kit, and I went, you know what? I don't need to do anything. I feel myself in this kit. It's loud, it's bright, and it was cool. So I hate when people do split answers, but they're two different kits, so they sort of don't, you know. If I had to choose one, I'd probably say more current day. I really did love that EF, original EF tie-dye kit.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that hit the ground running. That did create ripples, didn't it, in the cycling world? But no, great answers. And I'm not going to deduct you any points, not that I'm giving points for the split answer, because I think you completely legitimized it there, mate. So well done. Your favorite ever pro kit in history, not one you've necessarily been in, but it could be. So looking back through the annals of pro cycling, we've had some magnificent kits. Which one stands above them all for you, Mitch?
It's just so stereotypical. And I know, like, everyone says it, but I just can't go past it. I keep looking at old stuff. I was watching the 123 Roubaix the other day, Mappe kit.
Yep.
And it just hits all the right spots, that kit, you know, the colors and the riders. I think the team made that kit better too.
Yeah.
They just dominated. And it was loud. It was, you know, and the way they wore the kit, Taffy with the cut-off cap, you know, Museo with the Brico glasses. It was just the whole thing together. We on the Colnagos painted the Mappe with the blocks going down the top tube. Yeah, it's pretty cool, that stuff.
I think that's good. That's a lot of people's favorites. And of course, you still have one of the icons from that era within your team, Charlie Wegelius, wore that kit. I raced with Charlie. They even had, you know, like most teams will have a really nice design of kit, but then they'll have black leg warmers. But no, not with that. Well, not with those guys. Let's have brick kind of leg warmers as well. I mean, astonishing. I mean, it kind of burnt your retinas, but there was something beautiful about it as well.
It was great. And I love running into people, because you forget that team was so big. It was like 60 guys on the roster.
Nuts.
So you can actually keep running into guys who are on the team that I love. You're like, oh, like Scott McGrory, he was on it.
Yeah.
You know, Ken Chilari, you forget, was there. And
yeah,
the list keeps going on. You're like, oh, that's right, you're on Mappe, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Brilliant stuff. Okay, ultimate, you're only allowed one, ultimate shoe-sock color combination. So not the brand of shoe. You're not the brand, just the colours.
I like my combo at the moment. I've got a purple shoe with a blue sock.
Purple and blue. Okay. Yeah. And you're happy. You're kind of happy with that. I mean, it's quite modern. It's quite cutting edge, but it does work.
Like I guess everyone's going to say white and white, but the problem with white and white is you've got to just have an endless amount of either new shoes or new socks. It's just it's a disaster.
I think it only works if you're a cafe pro and all you do is ride in sunshine with brand new shoes and socks. But are you like me and a lot of people, like getting a new pair of socks out of the bag is something quite special, isn't it? Like putting them on. It's a lovely feeling, isn't it? And you push your foot through and the fabric kind of opens up for the very first time. God, what a feeling that is.
You take that little like soft like metal thing that holds the two socks together at the end. I love that little clip thing at the end.
Oh, yeah, that's part of the process, isn't it? I mean, and it also shows that these people who made these socks, they care. And that's a lovely thing.
They're hand pressed in at the end of the sock. Someone's job is to literally press that on so the two socks don't separate.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, worst teammate bus DJ.
Oh, throwing him under the bus here. Yeah. Simon Clark.
Oh, Clarky.
Sorry, Clarky. And if anyone out there is listening who knows. Look, I respect that he's got his own taste in music, and everyone does, and he doesn't mind showing it, but it's just not my taste. It's pretty techno-y.
Is it?
Yeah.
Is it like Euro techno, kind of Dutch techno, kind of like high beats per minute, that sort of stuff?
Actually, I'm going to almost take it back. You know who's worse than that? Bettiol.
Really?
Yeah, he's big into that Italian techno stuff.
Oh, God.
That's whereas Clarky's a bit more Australian, Triple J sort of like, late 90s sort of like crap.
Okay.
Whereas Bettiol goes the next level and does like, this new sort of Italian club mix. And you're like, dude, no one likes this.
Yeah. I mean, that's a bit of a surprise. I mean, that's blown me away a little bit, mate. A little bit disappointed in Bettiol there. But let's move on. Let's not put it down on the pod. I've enjoyed it so far. Okay. Right or left? Oh, no. Yeah, worst DJ. Okay. Right or left cycling shoe on first?
I have no specific one to think about.
You don't have a specific?
No.
I have to put the right one on. If I put the left one on first by accident, I have to take the left one off and then put the right one back on again.
Oh, mate, you're caught up in it.
I've got problems.
Yeah. I don't have an order. Not that I know of. I'm going to have to take note in the next couple of days. I'll have to come back to you. I'll send you a message. You have to put it up on the next pod. But I'm not aware.
Okay, so we'll just have a little guest slot and it'll be an update from Mitch on which one feels right. Okay, we're coming to the end of this little element of the quiz, of the podcast. Most special moment ever on a bike?
Okay, one that comes straight to mind is in 2011, Yes, 2011, I was in the breakaway at Paris-Roubaix. And as the story goes, we got caught late in the race.
Yeah.
And by the time we got caught, it was just the hitters left, sort of like 15 guys. It was the year that Johan van Summeren won.
Yeah, Cancellara was there, Balan, Eisel, Hushovd, all those guys.
Yes, yep. Boonen, you know. And. Yep. Lars Boom was there, your Fletcher, and I remember just being in there going, oh, this is just sick. Like I was content. I was like, I'm one of the players. I'm just rolling turns with these boys, you know, and that's you felt brilliant. Like one of the boys.
Yeah.
And I was starting to struggle and I thought my wife came to watch me on Sector 7. She wasn't my wife then, but I was just sort of like, almost getting dropped and almost giving up, you know, like day done, satisfied. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe two or three sectors away. I thought, I've gone this far. I'm going to just hang in and see her and I'm going to be in the front group. How cool is that going to be?
Brilliant.
So I struggled on. I get to the – and I saw it coming. Yeah, Sector 7, I've made it, you know. Come down off these. It's a really, really rough sector, but it's pretty fast. You go downhill and you turn right at the bottom. She was right there when you turn right onto the normal road at a barbecue. Yeah. I saw her. I looked across. There's a photo of me smiling at her. And I was just like, wow. you know, I got sort of that goosebumps feel. And that was the moment. But what that did for me there was it inspired me then to go on to the velodrome with those boys. I sort of went, oh, well, there's only six to go. Let's just do it, you know. But that moment there, it was special. And every so often I have that when someone's there on the side of the road watching me, it gives me that little bit of that boost. So that was definitely my biggest boost I've had.
Wonderful stuff, mate. That was the end of Mitch's Mullet Memories. Mitch's Mullet Memories. Edit point. There we go. Nice one, Mitch. I tell you what, do you fancy a quiz about Melbourne?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. It's time for the Melbourne quiz.
The Melbourne quiz. The Melbourne quiz. Now it's time for the Melbourne quiz.
Believe it or not, mate, we've got Alberto Bettiol to produce that jingle. Brilliant. Right. Okay. You're obviously born and, I believe, raised in Melbourne, Mitch. So I've done a bit of digging. Actually, I spent best part of an hour this morning researching this.
Oh, God.
But I'm not going to do your legs, mate. I'm not about that. This isn't about – it's slightly competitive, but it's all multiple choice. Right. So, you know, you should be absolutely fine. Just, you know, just guess. Four questions coming up now, all about Melbourne. Question number one. Okay. So Melbourne is the home to mainland Australia's oldest continually operating theatre, established in 1854. But what, Mitch, is that theatre called? Okay. Is it A, King's Theatre, B, Queen's Theatre, C, Princess Theatre, or D, Lord's Theatre?
C, Princess Theatre.
Correct. Oh, yes. There was not much hesitation at all. Have you been there? You're aware of the theatre?
Yeah, I have. But I got thrown with Queen Theatre because I'm like, oh. And then when you said Princess, I was like, oh, no, that's it.
That's the one. Well, it's a good start, mate. You've hit the ground running. You're sort of up and running with a 100% record. Question number two. Okay. The rock band Crowded House were formed in 1985 in Melbourne, despite half of the band being from New Zealand. But what was the name of the TV show that helped launch their career, as well as bands like Men at Work and the individual pop act Kylie Minogue? Okay, so what was the TV show that helped launch Crowded House's career? Was it A, Hitmakers, B, Rock and Pop a Go-Go, C, Hit World, or D, Countdown?
D, Countdown.
Oh, straight in the back of the net, mate. No hesitation there. Clearly, was that a pretty big show in Australia then?
I didn't know it was done before I was around, but Molly Meldrum, who used to run that show, is pretty famous in Melbourne. And a quick sort of fact for everyone out there, in Mitchelton, well, in Orica Green Edge, or Green Edge when it started, we went and recorded our own song with Molly Meldrum and we bought the rights to Won't Back Down. And we went into his studio and recorded. It was a pretty cool moment. And
that's brilliant.
And to meet Molly, he's a pretty famous sort of icon of Melbourne. So to meet him and wearing his hat and everything. So Countdown, yeah, you're never going to bugger that answer up.
No. Maybe a little bit too easy, but fantastic. You got a little kind of anecdote attached to that as well. If you've got any pictures, mate, of you in the studio, probably online, isn't it?
I think it is. Well, it's all part of that
backstage past stuff.
Yeah, you'll see
us
in there being idiots. It's one of the first backstages, just singing the song like absolute goons.
Brilliant stuff, mate. Right. Okay. It was 100% record. This is good. This is one of the best of recent weeks, actually. Question number three. Okay. Melbourne is quite renowned for its culture and art, but what was the name, Mitch, of the avant-garde group of artists who convened at Bulleen Dairy during World War II, now the site of a modern art museum? Okay. Was it A, the Angry Koalas, B, the Angry Penguins, C, the Angry Kangaroos, or D, the Angry Wallabies. So an avant-garde group of artists that convened at this particular place in Melbourne in World War II, now the site of a modern art museum. What was the group called? The Koalas, the Angry Koalas, Angry Penguins, Angry Kangaroos, or Angry Wallabies?
Wallabies?
I'm afraid it was the Angry Penguins, mate. Oh, I say, it's a good guess. It was just a guess, wasn't it? I mean, because I just made Pauline. The rest of them up.
It was in Bulleen, did you say? I actually grew up probably 5K from Bulleen. I went to school. My sports grounds were there. And I'm trying to think.
It's the Bulleen Dairy Farm. There's like a dairy farm there. The Bulleen Dairy Farm, yeah. And now it's the site of the Bulleen Modern Art Museum.
Yeah, I've been to that Bulleen Modern Art Museum. It's pretty cool.
What is it quite big? Is it because it's a, I didn't realize it.
Well, it's a park. It's the old Bundura Park there. And
okay.
Like, I really live close to there. Heidelberg is a suburb I live in, which is like 2K up the road. And it's a really cool park. They've sort of got all artworks in the bushland, and there's a really cool cafe there. And yeah, it's awesome, actually.
Nice one, mate. Well, there you go. I love the fact you got anecdotes for pretty much every question. I wonder if you got an anecdote for the final question. This is question number 4. Okay. The MCG, Melbourne Cricket Ground, established in 1853, held the world's first ever test match. But what year was that test match? Was it A, 1869, B, 1872, C, 1877, or D, 1880? And Mitch, for a bonus point, who did Australia play?
Was it 1880?
Oh, I'm going to give you another guess, mate. It wasn't 1880.
What year was it? What year was the MCG established?
1853. And the year of the first test match was 1869, 1872, or 1877. We've ruled out
1869.
It was 1877, mate. I'm sorry. No idea. But
Who did they play? Did they play England?
Yes. Bonus point. Oh, so basically you've got... out of four, you've got 75% in the Melbourne quiz. Let's have a round of applause for Mitch. Great stuff, mate. That was good. That was very, very good indeed. I noticed you kind of were keen on, you kind of mentioned a kind of nice cafe within the art gallery at the Bulleen Dairy Farm location. I know you're a big fan of coffee. So if you were to have your own coffee brand, what would it be called, Mitch? And what would be on the logo? Because I know you've got me harbouring potentially thoughts of having a cafe in the future at some.
Yeah, I haven't actually thought of the name of the actual bean. That's a good call.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like an answer. Maybe just kind
what
of
about,
talk about it.
What about something like a pull on the Peloton? Something like, you know, life in the.
Pello Bean.
You know what I always find funny is these names that are loosely connected to cycling that people like think that'd be cool when they're like they call it like bent spoke or broken derailleur cafe or you know like you know aero bar coffee shop. You're like, come on now, like seriously, you know, like worn out tire. Bike shop.
How about undercharged DI2? I mean, that'd be quite a technical kind of name.
Flashing Red Cafe.
Flashing Red Cafe. Double Tap Cafe, another brand. oh, God, I might have to help you out here, mate. God, Mitch Docker Cafe.
Yeah.
It's coffee beans.
What about just the cobblestone coffee, you know? Something really original. There's probably a name out there called that.
Cobblestone Coffee.
That's Sector 7 Coffee. There you go. Just talk about
Sector 7.
We just talked about Sector 7. It's my sector.
And that's one of your most inspirational moments on a bike. A coffee, as we know, is kind of weirdly inspiring in a kind of strange way. Sector 7 Coffee sounds absolutely. I'd buy some. I'm going to put an order in now for like 3 bags.
The roastery's life in the Peloton, and you're like, oh, what coffee? You go, well, grab yourself a bag of Sector 7. That's really good
mate.
Stuff.
It sounds brilliant, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Okay, next up, what would the logo be? So would it be a little – some cobblestones going around a corner with your wife with a barbecue waving like a sausage on the end of a fork, but on the end of the fork wasn't a sausage, it was a coffee bean.
That would be brilliant, yeah. Or just like, yeah, holding it, like she's like looking back and she's like busy roasting at the side of Sector 7, you know?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
I don't know, yeah.
I mean, that's just an idea. I mean, these are early days. We're just bouncing ideas around, mate. So when the pod's finished, I mean, ultimately.
You could have a rip-off of, instead of someone holding the stone up, you have a picture of me as if I've won Roubaix. And yep. Mounted on the thing, instead of a stone, is like a rough-looking coffee bean that looks sort of loosely like a cobblestone, but it's actually a bean.
I like that, mate. I like that. That's quite good. Yeah, I like that, mate. Okay, well, that's a work in progress, isn't it? And if Rigoberto Urán called you up and he'd heard us say something, this sounds good, Sector 7 coffee. You know, he's got his shop, hasn't he, in Colombia. What if he offered you a little franchise within there? How would you kind of decorate it? Because I want to know what this would look like as well. So would it be kind of all like retro stuff? Because, you know, he's offered you a franchise within his shop to sell your coffee. It's a little cheeky business proposition. As long as you made like 3 appearances a year.
You mean like on the walls and stuff, or you mean the furniture?
Yeah. So a bit of everything. So it'd be quite, you'd have like a stall, you'd have like the bench where you made your coffee and a few cakes. And then you'd have like a little soft area with like maybe 3 tables. But you could make it your own. It didn't have to be, it wasn't Rigo themed. It was you themed. What would the theme of it be?
I probably would keep it less bike than more.
Okay.
So I wouldn't have like, you know, seats with, you know, saddles and sitting on, you know, bikes, stools where you could sit pedaling and that sort of feel. Probably have it a bit minimalistic. And then I definitely have some great old Roubaix pictures, but old Roubaix pictures, like Sean Kelly sort of era, you know, not too old, but like 80s sort of era.
Yep.
Just hard bastards riding the stones.
Would there be, obviously, Rigoberto, the only thing he'd insist on is a picture of Rigo.
I try and find some kind of funny picture of him attempting to ride the cobbles in like the tour or something and get
that'd be
that
good,
up
wouldn't
there.
It? Would you be happy to put a picture of him up if it was one of those ones that you post without his top on? That'd be weird. Imagine if they said, look, Mitch, and you put the money up front, you'd invested, and they said, this is a deal breaker. There needs to be quite a big picture of him, a top off. What would you do? Would you
put in the male toilets?
That's a good, what a cracking idea.
Above the urinal.
Yeah, that'd be cool.
Behind the stall door.
Yeah.
Close the door, and next thing you know, you've got topless Rigo in there with you.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Absolutely fine. I think that would work. And I think it would probably satisfy him from a contractual perspective as well. Okay, Mitch, I've asked this of a few riders. What I'd like you to do is sum up in one word, one word only, all of the previous teams that you've ridden for. So let's include your brief stint with AG2R as a stagiaire as well, just to add another team. So obviously we've got AG2R, Drapac, Skill, Orica, and latterly EF. So one word, starting from now, sum up your brief stint with AG2R.
What's a good word? What's a word for just like...
Was it just really French?
I was in awe, you know, like I was just like.
Would it be wow?
Yeah, wow. For me, it was wow. Just
okay.
It was my first experience in the kit. So, yeah, sorry. It was wow. Yeah.
Good. Okay. AG2R, wow. Drapac.
Family.
Okay, I'm just writing this down. Family. I like that, mate. Was Tom Sotham there with you at Drapac? Yeah. Well, there you go. That's a little bit of a loop there. I get it. Skill, Shimano. One word, mate. 3 years. One word. It's got to be a good one.
This is not really a word, but like if I can
maybe
say it, like
maybe a sound.
It's just Dutch just says it all. Dutch. Like I know it's a Dutch team, but like I mean, Dutch in everything. You know, it was so Dutch. Yeah,
I think Steve Cummings described BMC as just American. Yeah. That's all he could think of. So Dutch is good, mate. Dutch is good. Orica. And you were there for a while, weren't you? 1, 2, 3, 6 years.
Yeah.
One word, mate. Remember, Matt Whitey does kind of listen to this pod sometimes. So,
yeah. It was just fun. That's a good word.
That's a great word, mate. That is a good. There's some good words here, mate. It's nice. And finally, EF, mate. Bear in mind, you're still under contract as well. That's the kind of a thing.
I want to say, like, liberating.
I like that.
Yep.
Liberating. Okay, so we've got wow, family, Dutch, fun, liberating, and you can mix and match those, whatever you want, mate. That's what a lovely way of, I just think it's a nice way to summarise. It's a very short way to summarise an entire career, but essentially, really positive. Really positive, mate. Yeah. Thanks very much indeed for that, mate. Okay, I've got one or two more questions, mate. We're kind of rambling on, and it's been really lovely speaking to you, mate. I know, what's the most challenging part? Because you've been the road captain for EF for a few years. And what's the most, it's just a two-pronged question. What's the most challenging part of being a road captain? And what is the most rewarding part of doing the job that you do for the squad, mate?
Probably the most challenging is actually understanding your responsibility in the situation. And like, I'm quite an emotional guy, and I can, especially in a grand tour, when everything builds up, second week, third week, you do forget that you're in a position of leadership and people are looking to you. And so little things that you just naturally do, you know, have a blow up, or, you know, you didn't get a bottle at the right time and you're pissed off because you're on a climb and you're thirsty, little things in the moment.
Yeah.
And you forget that has a big impact on young guys or even your perception of you from directors and stuff. So for me, it's in the heat of the moment stuff that I sometimes don't struggle with, but miss those cues. I'm like, oh, shit. You know, like, I just got too involved in the moment and didn't understand my position. As a rider, you can get away with that if you're not in a position of leadership or something like that. Because at the end of the day, you know, maybe not that many people are looking to you or whatever, and that's not your responsibility. But as you come in a different position, there's a lot of stuff that comes with that. But on the flip side, that is also a very motivating thing, because it's not all about you all the time.
Yeah.
Which you can make it about you. And when things are going good, that doesn't matter. But when things are going bad, and it's all about you, you get down in this little tunnel sort of vision syndrome where you just, oh, me, I'm all bad and blah, blah, blah. When you're in a position as a, like, let's say, a captain or a leader, or that, I feel like you try and you're worrying about everyone else. You just got to lead by example. You're like, I can't get myself down or whatever. You come down to the dinner table and you're like, I don't feel that good, but I've got to turn it on now. These guys are going to be expecting me to bring the energy, whether I want to or not. That's just my responsibility. And it snaps you out of your bad mood, which is a great thing. You just got to be aware of it, is all. Which is sort of what the best and worst thing is about it, you know?
Yeah, I was going to say there's an innate pressure in that. But also, if you do it right, the kind of the pressure actually pushes you to a place that is actually, I would imagine, massively rewarding, especially with, you know, even there might even be older guys in the team, but generally speaking, you know, when you've got young riders looking to you as an example, especially of morale, because we know how many kind of, I mean, look at you had a lot of bad luck, didn't you, in the 2018 Vuelta, for example, in terms of crashes and stuff like that. And a rider like yourself and the kind of positive attitude and just the way you know, this isn't just me just observing it. You are, you know, a popular guy, but there's still a pressure there, but to actually experience making a difference and seeing people, you know, and seeing people react to the way you are must be massively rewarding and almost like sweeten a lot of the pain you have to go through.
It's sort of a double-edged sword there because, yes, you aren't doing it for them to make everyone in the team go better. But at the end of the day, you're in that team too and you want a nice environment for yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm just like, yeah, screw it. If I'm not doing it for anyone, I'm doing it for myself here because I've still to go 2 or 3 weeks along with these guys. And if it's just going to be this sad clown depresso affair, I don't want to be involved in that. So you just start creating this atmosphere that you want to be in and lo and behold, it's positive for everyone too.
Yeah. What's off the back of that then, Mitch? What's the biggest change in the peloton you've seen since you turned pro? I mean, it's kind of seismic. So much has happened in a very short period of time. But what's the biggest shift that you've noticed in the over a decade that you've been racing to now?
I think it's probably the way I think the level has gone up. I just think about the way I used to train and go to races. It was just a little bit more happy-go-lucky. Everything is so well highly monitored now. You know, you can't get away with anything, if that makes sense. Every training you do, every minute you do, which is good and bad. Sometimes you can get a bit obsessive about it, and I definitely have done that too.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just need to let things go and just ride. You've got to have a strong mind to do that and a strong – and be very confident in your own ability to just go, you know what, I'm confident in what I'm doing. I don't care what the team sees on my training peaks or what they see on my Whoop band or whatever. I know I'm going to be good.
Yeah.
On the flip side, it's very easy to get caught up in that and make sure and have everything ticked off, green lights in the training peaks, sleep very good, and actually go to the race and not perform because you're already satisfied before you get there. So it's funny like that. I feel like when I was younger, the only thing that mattered was how you went in the race.
Yeah.
And it didn't really matter how you trained. That was up to you. Whatever you need to do to be good at the race, we don't give a shit. So just be good at the race. Yeah. And I love that fact because I feel like there's just a lot of engines coming into the bunch now who don't necessarily have, who haven't necessarily learned that race craft.
Yeah.
But are getting bought because of these things, because of accessibility to numbers, Strava, whatever you want to call it. Sure. And then it's like, you know what? He'll just learn how to race, no problems. But when you put like too many of those guys in the bunch, that I feel is why we're seeing so many stressful situations and crashes in the bunch because firstly, they haven't learned the race craft. And secondly, they haven't learned the sort of almost respect of the bunch. When I came in, it was like, look, Mitch, you're just going to do these jobs for 1 or 2 years, regardless how good you are, and work your way up. And I was happy for that. It wasn't like I was like, oh, God, poor me. When am I going to get my chance to sprint? It was just, that's just what I wanted to do. I was happy to sort of come up the ranks and learn each role before I got my chance. Whereas I feel like guys now well, you know what? I did the same Strava as George Bennett on a mere climb. So technically I should be able to sit second wheel into the climb coming into whatever race it is. It's like, well, no, dude, you can't just do that. That's just not how it works. Even though you might have the power, we're racing now. So maybe that is how it works, but that's definitely the biggest shift I've seen. There is, in one word, a lack of respect for people's abilities has gone out the window. If you've got the legs now, that's enough.
Yeah. Actually, interestingly, just before the Giro, I did Matteo Trentin was my guest on this pod, and he said it pretty much exactly the same thing, mate. And I know you're kind of a similar kind of age, a different generation, but that was pretty much exactly what he said. And I completely understand it, mate. It's interesting because, the peloton changes all the time as it modernizes, but it's just interesting to get your perspective on that, mate.
And I also see on that defense too, if you've come in now and that's all you know, that's okay too. I think it's just when you've had something before and it changes, you just don't like it. So all the guys now coming in, that's all they know, so that's fine. And just as you get older, you're like, God, this is hell. But things have got to continue to change, I guess.
Yeah. No, definitely. Describe to me, Mitch, what the Mitch Docker Grand Prix would look like. It's a race. You've retired. It's next year. A big sponsor's come up to you. Actually, Rigoberto Urán's come up with a lot of cash and said, Mitch, I want you to run your own race anywhere in the world. It's a one-day classic. Where would it be? How far would it be? What would the parkour look like, mate? It's the Mitch Docker GP, and it's a world tour race.
You know, I had this idea of actually starting my own race.
Okay.
I really like this idea. There's a town 300K from Melbourne.
Okay.
Goes around the coast. So the Port Phillip Bay in Melbourne. And it's the town, believe it or not, is called San Remo. And I was like, how is there not a Melbourne San Remo already? So maybe that would be it, because it's a classic and there's a climb just before San Remo. It's not, there's no like Kappas and Cipressa, but there's definitely a Poggio.
Okay.
So I reckon it's there. It's there in the making. The two towns exist. Melbourne exists. San Remo exists. There's a coast. Let's do it. That's my classic.
The Mitch Docker Grand Prix / Melbourne San Remo.
Mm.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
How good would that be? Just in that summer of Australian summer of – the Australian summer was getting cool. You know, you had Down Under. The Nationals were in there before. Then you had Cadells. You had another race around Cadells. Then you had Sun Tour. Just another couple of races in there. You would have been able to make a real go of it. I hope it comes back.
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely, mate. Well, I'll keep my ear closed. I mean, yeah, any help you need with that. And, well, specifically in designing a logo, that would be cool, mate. Hold on. We've got another. Oh, no. The old random side. I wanted to wrap things up, but.
Random question alert. It is time for a random question.
Okay. This is a pearler, mate, to wrap things up. And I don't apologise because it is random. I've nothing to do with them. I'd never get sight of these. But here we go, Mitch, to wrap up this podcast. You've just become a member of the Spice Girls, mate. What is your Spice name? Create your own. So you're a Spice Girl. You've just got another album to record. So it's a two-album deal and you're going to go on a world tour. And they've really welcomed you into the group. You're still Mitch Docker. You're a bloke. But what is your Spice Girl name?
So what do we have? We had Posh. We had Baby. Jerry.
Scary. Yeah.
Scary and Sporty.
That's it.
Bogan Spice?
Bogan. What? Bogan.
Yeah. You know what an Aussie bogan is, don't you?
No, I don't. You're going to have to explain it. I mean,
just Google it and you'll literally see a picture of me with a different face on it. My look is exactly Aussie bogan, which is just like...
Bogan. I've just thrown it up. I've got bogan Wikipedia. Jesus. Oh, my God.
Did anything come up?
Yeah, this weird picture of... it looks like... A bit of not a low life, but a bit kind of, yeah.
Did you do Australian Bogan?
I've just put Bogan Australia. Let me do Australian Bogan.
Well, yeah, it'd be more or less the same.
Yeah. Uncultured. Oh, I can see you. It's basically
a flannelette. Yeah. See the guy with the flannelette, cut off sleeves, the sunglasses, the goatee.
Just a fringe cut and then just like a bit of a mullet. I like Bogan. Oh, yeah, there's a drawing of one here. We've got Iron Maiden tattoos, a mum tattoo, scar on his face, beautiful mullet, quite a well-kept mullet with a pair of nunchuckers, one of the ones I'm looking at. So I reckon you'd fit in well. A Bogan.
Bogan Spice, there you go.
Bogan Spice, blimmin' it. We're going to have to get the guys at Sigma to actually try and knock a drawing up of you. Or just get Instagram to do it. We'll fire it out there, mate. But well, that was what a wonderful way to end what has been a thoroughly enjoyable podcast, mate. I really did enjoy that. That was Thanks for being so having such a laugh, mate. It's been a real, real pleasure.
Thanks for having me on. It was great. Lots of fun.
Just a quick reminder: if anybody's thinking, yeah, I want to listen to any Mitch's content, what pods can we hear you on that are your own?
Go and check out Life in the Peloton. We stream that now with the cycling podcast every 2 weeks. Okay. But over at my own feed, Life in the Peloton, you can also go to lifeinthepeloton.com to get all the episodes. But if you just go on Apple, you can get the Life in the Peloton episode. And we do this little spin-off series because my main guest is over at the cycling podcast. And then I do a little spin-off with them called Talking Luft. And that is just a little DVDs, extras, sort of talking crap. 15, 20 minutes, which is quite funny. So go across and have a listen to that. If you like those, you can hear the full episode over at the Cycling Podcast.
Good stuff, mate. Well, Mitch, it's been an absolute pleasure, mate. You take care of yourself. Best of luck with your next batch of races. I know you're doing the Route du Sud now. And then hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll see you in Paris-Roubaix. But until then, mate, you take care.
Awesome. Thanks, mate.
It's easy to see why Mitch is such a fan favourite. What a fun bloke. That was a blast. And I do wish him all the best with finishing up his career in style and a long and happy retirement from racing. This podcast is supported by Hot Chili. What's Hot Chili, I hear you ask? Good question. So let's ask the internet.
Hot Chili organises a variety of road and gravel cycling events in the UK and internationally, catering for riders of all abilities. Hot Chili has the cycling community at the heart of everything they do, and have a dedicated app for members to connect with each other.
Wow, sounds great. But of course, I did already know that. Visit hotchili.com or download the Hot Chili app and join the friendliest, funnest cycling community on the planet. Hot Chili is spelled HOTCHILLEE and .com is spelled full stop COM. Thanks to Perry App Gwyneth for the podcast theme tune, and thanks to you for listening. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and rate the pod, and want to recommend it to Rigoberto Urán if you see him topless while riding a bike on social media or in his Rigo Superstore in the real world. And finally, a massive thanks again to Mitch for joining us on the podcast today. Hope he enjoys his new life in the Spice Girls, and you can catch him on tour as soon as is safely possible. Cheers all, stay safe, and goodbye.